talking history. This is News Talk.
We shall fight on the beaches, we shall fight in the hills, we shall never surrender.
And out of that silence came thousands of voices.
The strategy of the white man has always been divide and conquer.
It's one small step for man, one giant leap for mankind.
Auch die Rollen, Argus, Akhoisa.
Good evening and welcome. We're talking history on News Talk 106 to 108 with me, Patrick Gagan. In tonight's show, for this St. Patrick's Weekend special, the invention, reinvention and myth-making around the iconic Irish brand Guinness, Catherine Healy about the letters and money sent home by Irish female immigrants in the 19th century, and to end the show, how to research your family tree. You can email us your thoughts and views, talkinghistory@newstalk.com, and we'd love to hear from you. We begin tonight's show with the history of Guinness. With just £100 in his pocket, Arthur Guinness left behind his family's small brewery in County Kildare to seek his fortunes in Dublin. Acquiring the ill-equipped St. James's Gate Brewery in 1759, he began to produce a porter beer that was to become world famous. And now a direct descendant of Arthur Guinness has retold that story. It's an expanded and redesigned edition of a classic short introduction. It has plenty of archival images and photography. It's called World of Guinness. It's published now for the first time in hardback. The author is Rory Guinness. And Rory, you're very welcome to the show.
Lovely to be with you today.
No, it's my pleasure. Now, can I begin? What is the direct connection? It's you're a great-great-great-grandson?
Would you believe it, Patrick? It's actually five greats back to the original Arthur. The original man who came in from Leixlip, he signed the 9,000-year lease on the brewery in 1759. As my children want to tell me quite often, yes, you look old enough.
And just on the point of that lease, what is going to happen in 8,800 and whatever years that does that property then revert somewhere else?
It's fair to say that the freehold was purchased somewhere along the line for all the different parts of the brewery, but so it will be forever Guinness. It'll be forever James's Gate, which is embossed in our hearts. But the exciting thing for us is that it's going to be a whole new quarter in Dublin with all the redevelopment around the Liberties and D8. It'll be transformed from an industrial area into what we think is going to be an exciting commercial, cultural and residential area. There is a lot of excitement in Dublin 8 at the moment, and safe to say that brewing of the famous stout will continue, though, right in the heart of the Liberties.
And it really was an ideal location if we go back in time to 1759. And what made it so good?
Well, I tell you one thing. You could argue I'll give you two sides of the story. One side is that, yes, it was good. It was outside the city gates, which meant that immediately Arthur Guinness had a tax advantage to those brewers that were brewing inside the city gates. That's the first thing. The second thing was access to beautiful water, which is the fundamental building block of all good beer. And the water supply was something that he once was so aggravated about the threat of the water being cut off, that he actually took a pickaxe to some bailiffs that were sent round that threatened to cut him off. But the joy was that he protected his water supply, because the water supply is actually enshrined in the 9,000-year lease. Now, there's another side to that story, which is to say, why did he buy a dilapidated brewery where the previous brewer had gone bankrupt and the brewery was lying in ruins? Well, that's certainly a disadvantage if you walk into a derelict site and you want to start business immediately. The other thing that was that there was other breweries on that street, and there were loads of breweries. I once heard there was 32 other breweries within Dublin at that time. So he faced enormously stiff competition. He was an entrepreneur. He had a vision. He had obviously a skill set that he had developed over previous years working for Arthur Price, Archbishop Cashel, who was based in Leixlip. So he knew something about the trade. And I think something that is testament to his success was the fact that he was made a liveryman in the Guild of Brewers shortly after he started brewing in Dublin.
And in those early years, people who would be buying a Guinness would actually be buying an ale or a light beer, and that it's only as time went on that he saw the popularity of these darker beers being drunk in London. And so he began brewing his own porter and brewing his own stout. His son, Arthur, as well, continued with all of this. And it was a series of experimentation. And it really shows that vision to try and see if you could develop something new.
Always trying to do something better than the generation before. And always wanting to adopt the latest scientific advances that'll produce a finer beer, a finer stout. And don't forget this, when he started brewing, such were the insanitary conditions, in particular concerning water supply around Dublin, that the horrific death rates meant that a lot of people were dying too early, and they were doing because of the lurgies within the water supply, and beer was a natural solution because the beer, the alcohol within the beer, a light ale, would actually kill the bugs that were killing so many. So beer was something that was looked on as a luxury. Yes, only richer people could afford it, but also as a necessity in order to maintain your health.
So at what point was the brand that we're familiar with now, a drink that's brewed with barley, water, hops and yeast, at what point was that developed?
Well, one thing that's really noticeable about successive generations of my family is the fact that the name has always been over the door. Not only that, but the name has always been on the bottle. Now, what that means is there's a certain family pride, there's a certain amount of family ingenuity that has gone into the brand. So I would argue that the brand has been in place since 1759, when Arthur started inventing started brewing in James's Gate. Now, when it really began to take off was in his latter years, when he particularly noticed that stout sales around London were doing particularly well, and he brought back thoughts from the Billingsgate market in London as to how to brew a porter. It was really then that in the 1780s, 1790s, that he began to actually become synonymous with stout or porter as we know it. And of course, the St. James's Gate location enabled not only the import of barley from up and down the country, but also the export from St. James's Gate to markets within Ireland. Again, the location was something that was incredibly important, with the Grand Canal so close, and Dublin Port just up the road. So by kind of 1800, you're beginning to see exports to the UK, 1830s, you begin to see exports to North America and the Caribbean, and then started a tradition of exporting that's continued to this day.
Yeah, I see that there was a West Indian version that was produced for long journeys and long distances, so that they were getting a West India porter that was different from what you might be getting in Dublin.
And the reason it was brewed to a higher gravity was to ensure that it arrived in peak condition. Even when there were punitive taxation on Irish brewers in Napoleonic war times, there was a real tendency amongst my family to actually subsidise the cost of producing a pint of beer because barley was being taxed through the roof. So it's this really interesting. There's this really interesting history within Guinness that shows a little bit of how an Irish company, how an Irish family has taken a name, a brand, and an ethos, and have developed it into something that is now, I'm very delighted to say, world renowned and known for being different things in different markets.
When did the harp become the symbol then that people so closely associate with it? I know that it was registered as the trademark in 1876 and, as you say, one of the world's oldest existing trademarks. But do we know when it actually started appearing next to the product?
Benjamin Lee Guinness, the famous Lord Mayor of Dublin, who sits outside St. Patrick's Cathedral, took that decision to trademark the Brian Boru harp. And it has been sat alongside a bottle of Guinness since that time. And the Brian Boru harp was actually purchased by the family and later gifted to Trinity College. But the symbol itself, he recognised the value of trademark material. And he very, very, very cleverly trademarked it. Which caused a bit of consternation, I'm sorry to say, when it came to the foundation of the state, because there was a certain president in the form of a friend of his called Eamon de Valera, who turned around to him and said, who said to my great grandfather Rupert, "Excuse me, we've got we've got a country here, we've got a state, and we wouldn't half mind the harp back." To which I'm very sorry to say that my great-grandfather, Rupert, turned around and said, not sure about that because we've trademarked it. He said, but what about flipping it? And so that is why the Brown Brew harp and the Guinness harp are juxtaposed.
As you show, it came quite late to the advertising game, and it was really only in the 1920s that it saw the opportunities and the potential there.
So right, and basically, it came as a result of falling market share. Back in the 20s, my great grandfather Edward Cecil Guinness, he was a skeptic when it came to the power of advertising. As soon as he saw the sales figures towards the end of his life, his son began thinking about how to advertise. And the early adverts are actually really medical, and we would look at them today and say they're slightly boring because they're not sexy, they're not funny, they're not apposite. But for those times, and it is exactly expressed why people drank Guinness. That then later transpired into the much more whimsical campaigns of the 30s and the 40s.
No, Guinness is good for you. It really is one of those iconic slogans. And I don't think it's a slogan that would be allowed now. I don't think it would get through the regulators, because now people would be much more concerned with showing the risks, potential risks in terms of liver disease and high blood pressure, alcoholism and other health issues. And, you know, is there any concern with a slogan that is perhaps pitching benefits that are not there?
There certainly are, and consenting adults, because I think being a member of the family, I'm very conscious of the negative side of alcohol, and we've always been very conscious of the place that alcohol roles in, the positive but the negative role that it can play in life. So I think a modern Diageo could never talk about the health benefits of alcohol, and quite rightly so, because it's a very regulated market, and so it should be. But in the historical context, as an author, I think it's really important that we remember where alcohol has come from, and we appreciate the creativity and the scientific endeavour. You know, I'm very proud of the fact that my father, when he took over as chairman of Guinness, he would have taken on that role He was the biggest single private employer in the country. He also would have been in a place where Guinness was the largest payer of corporation tax to the Exchequer in the 1960s. That route, that lineage is something that we as a family are very proud of. And I really hope that my book manages to capture a little bit of the richness of that history.
Talk to me about the Guinness Book of Records, because again, that's something that people would associate with the brand. And it seems to have begun really as a way of settling contentious pub debates.
Oh, what a wonderful story that is. I mean, there they were, Sir Hugh Beaver, 1950s, shooting on the North Slob. And the question is this: what is the fastest game bird? To which no one within the shooting party could answer. But it started off a thought from Sir Hugh, who was the then managing director of the company. And one of the under brewers at that time in Parker Oil was Christopher Chataway, he of the famous running fame. Anyway, Christopher and knew of a pair of twins in Oxford University who were starting a fact-finding agency. They happened to be the McGuirter twins, and the McGuirter twins were brought on board by the brewery from Oxford to start thinking about how to incorporate their expertise into putting together the what became the Guinness Book of Records to settle all pub disputes. And in itself, it has become the most incredible publishing success. Nowadays, it doesn't carry the Guinness harp, but it is one of the best-selling books of all time. The Bible and Quran would be up there in prime positions, so to this day it's not part of the family's life anymore, but it carries on producing some incredible successes in terms of the most extremely interesting facts that my 11-year-old is delighted to memorize and regurgitate rapidly. So it's still providing a lot of entertainment.
How did the Ivy Trust come about? And was there a deliberate decision to give something back to Dublin and to try and provide for those less fortunate?
The Ivy Trust is a very key part of my life. So I'm the chairman of the Ivy Trust, and we are one of Dublin's biggest social housing providers and the oldest social housing provider in the island of Ireland today. So after the flotation of the brewery, which happened in 1886, Edward Cecil Guinness, my great-great-grandfather, he basically was an incredibly wealthy man. And with that money, he undertook a series of charitable endeavors. Because of the root, because of our roots in science, we knew that microbial activity was extremely dangerous. And so his thinking along the lines of providing not just fresh water, but also sanitary conditions for workers within Dublin led him to building all the ivy buildings around Kevin Street and St. Patrick's Park, which we still operate to this day. And it's really interesting. If you walk into some of the early blocks, you still see the tiles on the wall, which was a technology that was imported directly from the brewery and put it to use in housing. And that was revolutionary in the 1890s. And the idea that you would be washing down your walls and everyone would have access to fresh air and light, I think only in recent years have we been reminded of that through COVID. So he was a really far thinking radical when it came to social entrepreneurialism, and he built around the Ivy Trust. He actually undertook to build the buildings himself on his personal account. He then handed the keys over to a set of trustees, of which he was one. But it was that insistence that there was the very personal involvement is something that still guides us to this day. Because I'm delighted that, you know, I am one of four members of the Guinness family on the board of the Ivy Trust. And we, to this day, provide not just buildings, but we hopefully provide a community. We hopefully provide something, opportunities for people who live with us, within our communities, opportunities that they wouldn't otherwise have. And that could be centered around choirs, that could be centered around getting together with your neighbors and playing bingo, that could be centered around trips for some of the older citizens once, twice a year, meals out, and so on and so forth. We basically put a bit of heart and a bit of soul back into the communities. Today, in the Ivy Hostel, for example, we'll be housing 193 men who might not otherwise have anywhere to go. And across north, south, east, and west of Dublin, we have close on 1,700 homes, each providing not just a roof and a home, but also hopefully a community and a place that people can call home within Dublin.
What about Guinness in the 21st century? Because, of course, you now have Diageo formed in 1997 out of that merger, I think, between Guinness and was it Grand Metropolitan. You have the introduction of new products like Guinness Zero, which I think has meant that the product has reached an entirely new audience. And there have been quite significant changes over the past 25, 28, 30 years.
Massive changes. There's been massive changes, I think, within technology, which meant that, you know, thousands and thousands of people that my father would have employed when he took over running the brewery in 1963, there's now a few hundred that are running St. James's Gate. The other thing that's changed is customer taste. I mean, the brilliant move to 0.0, to low alcohol and no alcohol beers. And I think that is partially due to the history and the innovation and the fabulous scientific expertise that exists around St. James's Gate.
Not a drop from the River Liffey. And that's, again, part of the mythology or part of the stories that spring up, that even now it's water from Wicklow springs and reservoirs. But even in its earliest days, it used other rivers around Dublin, but not the Liffey.
Not the Liffey, thank God. I mean, would you? I'm not sure that I would. I mean, the Doddle, the Poddle, the Wicklow, Wicklow Springs, that they've all featured in various different ways. The importance of water is fundamental, not just to the brewing process, but also to the export and so on and so forth. So, I mean, Dublin Port and the proximity there of the seaways and the access of Guinness into Liverpool, into Runcorn for distribution, and also now through Belfast, is a really, really, really crucial. I mean, how Ireland is connected to the world is a really crucial thing, even to this day.
Well, it's a beautifully produced book. It's called World of Guinness. Now, of course, we're not encouraging our listeners to drink Guinness or indeed any other form of alcohol. But if you do decide to drink this weekend, then please drink responsibly. We'll be back with more Talking History on News Talk right after this.
Hey, buddy, want to go to the dog park? Go with Simparica Trio. It's triple protection made simple. Simparica Trio is the first monthly chewable that covers heartworm disease, ticks and fleas, round and hookworms. This drug class has been associated with neurologic adverse reactions, including seizures. Use with caution in dogs with a history of these disorders. Be sure to tap to read the full prescribing information. Protect him with all your heart. Ask your veterinarian about Simparica Trio. Tap or visit SimparicaTrio.com to learn more.
So much of what we want to do can seem impossible, but the highest achievers among us are the people still reaching for something, the ones who aren't satisfied to stay where they are and want to keep climbing higher. It's those people who approach the impossible and embrace it. There's a vehicle for people like that. It's called the Defender. The Defender is an icon reimagined through thoroughly modern design. It's got a tough, rigid body design and durable, lightweight monocoque architecture for extra strength. With precise detailing and compelling proportions, the exterior of the Defender is designed with integrity. This is a vehicle capable of great things, engineered to meet challenges head-on with an exterior that's been tested to the extreme. Experience the Defender's legendary capability off-road and on. And there's a family of vehicles for Defender. Meet the Defender 90, Defender 110, and the 8-seat Defender 130. So, are you ready to embrace the impossible? Explore the Defender at LandRoverUSA.com.
Welcome back. We're talking history. Immigration is a crucial part of the Irish story and a crucial part of the St. Patrick's Day story. I'm delighted to be joined by Dr. Catherine Healy, the DFA historian in residence at EPIC, the Irish Immigration Museum, to talk to us about a brilliant piece you wrote for the Sunday Times about some pioneering Irish women who sent money home from the United States. Through their letters home, we see the sacrifices they made, the weight of financial responsibility they carried, and the resilience that defines so many. Catherine, you're very welcome back to the show.
Thanks, Patrick. Great to be here.
It was a great piece in the Sunday Times, and it was, you know, you're able to draw a lot of this material out of this wonderful repository that is connected with the University of Galway.
That's right. Yeah, the IMRCA project. It was launched in 2023 and based on the vast collection of emigrant letters gathered by Kirby Miller over several decades. So it's a fully digitized collection of thousands of letters from North America spanning four centuries. And if you know, if you go and see it online, you can filter by gender, by location, and see what kind of material is coming in either direction over a very long period of time.
Why were you particularly drawn to the story of Annie Carroll?
Annie Carroll was a woman of a few words. She had, I would say, a difficult life. The American dream was not what her life ended up being. She went to America in 1883 and eventually ended up working as a servant in Chicago. And her letters really clearly show the weight of obligation that she faced over many, many years and the extent to which her family relied on her. She ended up helping to bring her brother home. And over a long period of time, she was covering the rent for the family farm. She was sending back as much money as could be saved. Eventually, she had an injury and had to quit her job. So it made it more difficult to be able to support family back at home, although she did as best as she could do. And there's also a kind of a sad story of heartbreak as well that comes through these letters. She had been due to marry an Irishman in America, and her cousin ended up running off with this man and getting him to got him to marry her instead. So you get a real sense of the resentment that Annie felt over that. And she ended up very sadly, it's believed, in an asylum. So it could be said that the pressure on her to send money home, you know, made it very difficult for her to be able to have an independent life of her own.
And I was very struck by the fact that people back home almost saw these women as bank machines, that the priest approached the family back in Ireland to say, oh, could she send over some money? And the sister had to say, well, actually, she's in a bit of trouble at the moment and can't. But it really does seem that people thought, oh, let's make a request for maybe some help.
Yeah, I mean, particularly in the west of Ireland, a lot of families were reliant on remittances, and particularly remittances from women in domestic service. These were people who were in a position to save a lot of their earnings. And, you know, we can really see in the records from that period just the huge volume of women, of money being sent back by women. And one of the largest exchange agencies set up in America to cater to Irish immigrants, it's believed that they sent back something like $180,000 a year just from servants contributing money back home. And, you know, for that reason, it was often seen as a better financial investment to send a daughter out as opposed to a son. If you look, for example, at Vere Foster's assisted emigration schemes. He was this Anglo-Irish philanthropist who funded primarily women to leave Ireland and go and get work in America. And he deliberately chose to prioritise young women. And you can see in his letters in Prony the very large lists of women's names sent to him by parish priests across the country looking for help to send over their young girls.
And what's remarkable about the letters and something you comment on is how peripheral work seemed to be to what they were preoccupied by in these letters, that it's more about friends, it's more about family, it's more about their sense of obligation about having to send money home, but they're not really chatting about what they're getting up to or about the kinds of things they're doing.
Yeah, that's true. And there's a lot of humour in the letters too. You really see how much leisure is prioritised, you know, how important it is for women to be able to put money aside for new dresses, for going to dances. Even going to mass every week was, you know, an important social outlet. And you really see that stress in the correspondence. Work is something that doesn't quite define their identity, at least from the material that we see them write. But of course, I mean, we have to be conscious as well that there might have been a desire to shield relatives from the realities of their lives in America. Like many immigrants today, you know, you're not going to want to tell your parents just how difficult life is after leaving them and potentially never returning.
And sometimes you see them supporting major political and social causes. So Michael Davitt and the Land League get, I think it's a $200 in gold, and it's coming out of this work.
Yeah, Michael Davitt wrote of that particularly generous domestic servant who donated a huge sum in recognition of her family's own struggles with their landlord. And we do know that a lot of working class Irish women were involved in the American Ladies Land League, which had branches right across the US. And a smaller proportion did contribute to groups associated with the Fenian movement. And actually, if you look at transatlantic media coverage of the Fenian Brotherhood right up to the Land League and the IRA as well, moving into the early 20th century, the Irish servant becomes a really common trope with which to, you know, castigate Irish nationalists. You know, we get all sorts of cartoons of O'Donovan Rossa and his like going with their begging pots to Irish servants because it was seen that they had too much more money than sense, really, and could be relied upon to give a dig out when needed.
And it is interesting what you say about these caricatures, cartoons and the stereotypes. And there does seem to be this image of the Bridget figure, the strong-willed servant who has no qualms about demanding better terms and conditions and better money. And there is a very kind of a strong image that there is of these working Irish women.
Yeah, and it does reflect, I suppose, the leverage that Irish immigrant women did have when it came to the domestic service marketplace. There was a huge demand for servants and a lot of them were able to more or less pick or choose between employers in places like New York and Boston. And you see this again in the correspondence. I left a job after 3 months because I wasn't being allowed to go to mass. I left a job after 6 weeks because I wanted to be closer to the city. So there is some kind of leverage there, and that's really blown out of proportion then in cartoons that you see in the likes of Puck and in women's magazines. You get constant complaints about the belligerent Bridget wanting more money than she was really entitled to.
How significant was the money that was being sent home? Because, you know, did it make a difference in terms of what life was like for the people receiving it, in terms of the local communities? How much of an impact did it have?
It had a huge impact. You know, there's evidence from the early 20th century that about half of the rents in one particular parish in Galway were being covered by emigrant remittances. And you see in the letters being sent between emigrants and their families, just the desperation with people would write from Ireland saying, I haven't heard from you in a while. We could really do with a little help on that front. And sometimes people chose to cut all contact because they were not in a position any longer or no longer wanted to give that money over.
You mentioned the broken match for Annie Carroll. It also seems that many of the women had this dream of maybe returning home and making a match back in Ireland.
Yeah, some do manage to go home and make a new life for themselves back in Ireland and sing in his writings on his travels through the west of Ireland refer to a conversation he has with a local man about the women who go over to America and come back, you know, in their fine dresses, looking for a man to settle down with, and how attractive a prospect they were compared to the women who had stayed at home.
And it probably wasn't a huge amount of money that they were earning in American terms. It's just that when it was compared to what people had back in Ireland, it seemed like a huge amount of money.
That's right. Yeah. I mean, like with so many migrants today who send money home, and the difference it makes for their families is considerably more than the difference it would make for them in the places where they settle.
And there kind of is a message about for today, about what we can see from some of these challenges, balancing financial independence with family obligations, the emotional weight of migration, the expectation to support loved ones. You know, a lot of these themes still are there when we talk about migrant workers today.
Absolutely, yeah. And I mean, you see a real pride in the correspondence that women were able to assume this position. You know, they'd broken away from the patriarchal family structure at home and gone over to a place and become then the source of authority for people back in Ireland and what conditions were like. And yeah, I think you can see a lot of the same themes in, you know, writings of migrant women from later periods.
So tell me what you're working on now. There seems to be an exciting new exhibition being developed around passports.
That's correct. We're developing a new exhibition in association with the Department of Foreign Affairs on the history of the Irish passport, marking a centenary of its first release to the public. So we'll be looking at how the document has evolved over those decades, and stories relating to migration, and we're looking for people to donate material, and we'll be gathering stories from people on, you know, whether it be their experience of getting a passport for the first time as a new Irish citizen, getting a passport in their new name as a trans person, or, you know, getting a passport to leave the country and make a new life abroad.
Which is exactly what so many people had to do in the past. Well, my thanks to Dr. Catherine Healy, the DFA, that's Department of Foreign Affairs, historian in residence at EPIC, the Irish Emigration Museum, talking to us about some of these pioneering Irish women of the past. Catherine, thanks so much.
Thank you.
We'll be back with more Talking History and how to research your family tree right after this.
Hey, buddy, want to go to the dog park? Go with Simparica Trio. It's triple protection made simple. Simparica Trio is the first monthly chewable that covers heartworm disease, ticks and fleas, round and hookworms. This drug class has been associated with neurologic adverse reactions, including seizures. Use with caution in dogs with a history of these disorders. Be sure to tap to read the full prescribing information. Protect him with all your heart. Ask your veterinarian about Simparica Trio. Tap or visit SimparicaTrio.com to learn more.
So much of what we want to do can seem impossible, but the highest achievers among us are the people still striving, still reaching for something. It's those people who approach the impossible and embrace it. There's a vehicle for people like that. It's called the Defender. The Defender is an icon, reimagined for a new generation of explorers and fully equipped for 21st century adventures. 3D surround cameras with ClearSight ground view let you see underneath the vehicle and anticipate obstacles and rough terrain. And ClearSight Rear View offers an unobstructed rear view, even when you can't see through the back window. Driver aid technologies make driving and parking simpler, while intuitive driver displays are customizable to your journey. Plus, the next generation Pivi Pro infotainment system helps make more of your world. There's a family of vehicles for Defender too. Meet the Defender 90, Defender 110, and the 8-seat Defender 130. Are you ready to embrace the impossible? Explore the Defender at LandRoverUSA.com.
Welcome back. Now, to end the show tonight, we're going to give you some advice on how to get started researching your family history. And I'm delighted to be joined by Stephen Skeldon, the manager of the Family History Service at the National Library of Ireland, because we really associate libraries with books. But do you know that every year thousands of people visit the National Library in person and online to research their family history? And they offer a free family history service to assist researchers, and they also provide free access to a number of genealogy subscription sites in all of their reading rooms. So Stephen, you're very welcome to the show, and I have to say, I wasn't aware of this service.
Yes, so I suppose when people think of the library, they do think of books, they think of people going in that might be writing their own stories, or they might be literary research that they are carrying out, but they don't realise that if the library, they have the family history room, and it's quite a unique space in the library. So most institutions will have a reading room, but the National Library also have a family history room, and that is a unique aspect of what the library offers.
So where should someone start? Should they come in? Like, obviously we have the census from 1901 and 1911 that they've been digitized through the National Archive. But in terms of the National Library, what resources are available? What should they do? What are the first steps?
So the first step is to visit the library's website, www.nli.ie. We have a tab at the top of the page for family history, and we have a section below that for getting started. So we have a dedicated page where you can actually just visit and see where should I begin. That provides you with some basic advice about talking to family and collecting records. So people, when they're getting started, are getting started at different points. Some people may already have some information and some people may know very little. So I suppose the key thing is, what is your starting point? And if you visit the Getting Started page, we provide free templates, family group sheets and charts that you can download and fill in information. So what I'd recommend that you do is visit the Getting Started page under Family History, download the group sheets. At the very bottom of the page, you'll see a button to download it, and talk to family and start to fill in those sheets with information that you already know. The source of information that is recorded on a group sheet would be when someone was born, if they married, the dates of marriage, how many children do they have, what are their names, where are they buried, what was their occupation, all the very basic information about your family that maybe you know some of it or you think you know. And also recording the parents' names. So we recommend that you do that for your grandparents or your parents first before you jump back in time. So you might think that you know about your great-grandparents, but do you know all about your own grandparents first? How many siblings did they have? What did they do for a job maybe? What kind of education had they? All of these questions that might open up record sources. Then you very quickly you'll identify gaps. So we use the group sheets to focus not only what do we know, but what do we not know? And once you have that written down, you have it all in one place. It's organized in a way that you can say, right, this is where I need to go next to get help. And on the family history page, we have another subsection, another page below family history in the library called Further Research. And that is where there's information about census records that you mentioned, and also about what we call civil records. So those are the two key categories where people will get started. The census returns are only available for 1901 and 11. So if you have family that you know where they lived at that time, do start with the census records. But once you move beyond those, you will need to look at the civil records. That's births, deaths and marriages that the government has issued from 1864. So that's the date that civil records in Ireland begin. So we can search those free of charge on the irishgenealogy.ie website. All of these links are provided from the library's page. When it comes to the electronic resources that we pay for in the library, some are free and some we pay for. So those are available on the collections page. So if we go into the library and we click on collections at the top, there's a section called e-resources. And the e-resources list all of the genealogy sources that we have that are free, but also the ones that we pay for. So they would include subscription sites. The two largest are Find My Past and Ancestry. So people might be familiar with Ancestry from taking a DNA test, but they also provide access to search historical records, including National Library of Ireland collections. So the largest collection that we have on there are the Catholic parish registers, baptisms and marriages mainly. And those are accessible on Ancestry. So what people don't always know is that they can access the registers page from the library's website, but that doesn't allow you to search by name. What the library provides is a copy of the parish register, and you have to read the handwriting, okay? And that's part of the joy of family history, if you want to call it that. But it's one of the tricky things that people maybe stumble on. But you can search by name if you access ancestry or find my past. So those sites are linked to from the library's website and they're free to use while you're in the library. And for anyone that isn't, I suppose, in Dublin, you can also check in with your local libraries. So that's another aspect, is that your local library may also have access to some, but not all of those sites that we have in the library.
And how many people would come to the National Library every month to avail of the service and to research their family history?
So we would receive, I suppose it's very seasonal. We receive large numbers over the summer period. And in the winter period, several hundred would come in. And those numbers would climb in the summer months. Some people may be only in for 10 minutes to have a conversation with us. Other people might stay the whole day and come back for weeks. So one of the first questions we ask people is, how long do you have? Because it does take time to do family history research. So we do.
So hundreds of people. Yeah. Incredible. Hundreds of people a month in the summer. And you're able to provide this incredible service. So that really is remarkable. And that is a brilliant service. And are the people mainly from Ireland, outside of Ireland, the United States, Australia? Where are they coming from?
So in the winter months, most of our visitors are from Ireland. And in the summer, it flips in reverse. And they're mainly international visitors. The largest contingent would be from the United States, followed by Great Britain. And then after that, we'd have smaller numbers from Canada and Australia. We do also receive a very small number from other areas that the Irish diaspora have settled in, for example, in South America. But those would be very small numbers compared to those that come from the United States and from Great Britain.
OK, so given the weekend that it is, what are the problems then that family members find when they're trying to research their history? And there are gaps, because you've mentioned there about 1867 for the civil records. But if you have people who emigrated, whose ancestors emigrated during the famine years, that's 20 years before. So are there gaps in the records and are there obstacles there when they're trying to get back as far as they can?
Absolutely. And I suppose the key thing is to look to understand where someone is from if they've moved from Ireland to a different country. And that's where the census records in other countries come in. So the library pay for a worldwide subscription to Ancestry. And what that means in practice is that if your ancestor moved to England or the United States, you can look them up on that census and it will tell you if their parents were born in Ireland, for example, in the US census. So you figure out, are the parents Irish? Is the person Irish? That will then determine where you look in the sources. However, before 1864, we don't have a complete set of records. So we need to know which county and specifically which parish someone is from. So a common roadblock is trying to figure out, well, this is an Irish name. Where's this Irish name found in Ireland? So we pay for access to a site called Irish Ancestors. It's a subscription site by the genealogist John Grenham. And this site allows you to put in a surname and then you can view a distribution map from before 1864. So it's a source from the middle of the 19th century around the famine that will give you a distribution of where that name is found in Ireland. Some names are restricted to a particular area of a county, and that is great help to then focus on, well, what are the church records? Pre-1864 is church records. We're looking for baptisms and marriages. But those don't survive in full. And in some cases, there are no records, okay? So that's something that people, they may have encountered a roadblock thinking they've done something wrong. Actually, you've done nothing wrong. But what you need to do is determine where in Ireland they're from. And that can be quite tricky if the US Census returns, say, the person is born in Ireland. It doesn't say which county, okay? Some names are distributed throughout the island, and in which case, you know, it's very tricky to determine where in Ireland they're from. So the advice that we often give to people is, have you squeezed all of those sources in your home country, if it's the United States? Do you have their death certificate? So in the United States, the death certificate records the names of the parents of the person. So that has deceased. In Ireland, that doesn't happen. So it's just this person died on this day. We don't know who their parents were. And the same in Scotland. So in some countries, if your ancestors have gone there, you're able to go back a generation, you get the parents' names, but the record of that person's birth doesn't survive. So you're piecing together information from a death certificate. So there's lots of different places that you can look for information. That's where the Family History Service and the library come in. So if you've reached that roadblock, to contact us through the library's website and tell us what is it that you're stuck with. And we will provide that advice by email. So those numbers that I gave earlier are people that physically come into the library. We also have similar numbers of people that just get in touch remotely and we welcome those queries from anyone around the world.
And really, it's about helping people to identify what types of sources are even available, because people just wouldn't know what are these resources? What types of materials are there? What types of collections? So should everyone do some homework beforehand? Should they check the website? Should they look at what is available and what how much information they can find before they come? And then if it is possible, they take you up on one of these free consultation appointments where you really, I suppose, are kind of providing a roadmap for how they might carry out their investigation.
Absolutely. The preparation is key. So the reason that we have an appointment-based systems for the consultation is to allow people the time to collect their information together, to look at the library's website, the family history pages in particular, with the Getting Started page and those worksheets that we mentioned earlier, but also the further research page that would break down into categories the types of records that are available. So we mentioned the civil records of births, deaths and marriages and the census records. But there are other sources. There are property records, tax records, other places that people can look. So what we've provided is a very brief outline of those. So people should familiarise themselves with the record types and the dates that are referenced on that page before they get in touch with us. And then if they are planning a trip to Ireland, we encourage those appointments. Now, of course, if people come into the library, they do also need a reader's ticket and there's other procedures in place. So really just explore the library's visit page and to learn more about what you need to prepare for your visit.
And what's the age profile of the people that come? Are people more interested in researching their family history when they're maybe older in life? They may have children or grandchildren of their own. Are there younger people coming in who are curious about the past? I'm wondering about the profile of your visitors.
Sure. So I suppose it really is a thing that takes a bit of time. So quite often if for people when they retire, they have more time available on their hands that they can visit the library. So that would be the traditional age profile of people researching their family history in the past. But what we found during the pandemic is that people had maybe more free time on their hands. They weren't socializing as much. And so there's a new audience being engaged. And then secondary to that, there would also be DNA and genetic tests. So we find that young people in particular are very keen on the DNA tests that are on offer. And those quite often throw up questions maybe about, well, I didn't realise I had Irish ancestry. Where do I go now for information? So that age profile would be lower. So it really just depends on where the person is coming from and their background. But there is an older age profile traditionally associated with family history research, something that we're trying to break down barriers on and encourage people at all ages to engage. But we also do have class visits to the library from schools. And there is a section on the website for that, for schools to get in touch and to reach out about maybe engaging with the library. And in that situation, you might get someone to look more at the local history, people who lived in your house. So, you know, you get people doing family history, but sometimes it's more local history. And there's a bit of an overlap there where people are interested in, well, who lived in my house before, you know, and they're doing a school project. So there is different levels of engagement. And one thing that's really nice is when adults come in with a child, you know, and they ask those questions and you can see the interest from them. And they have very interesting questions, you know, about what did the house look like and so on. And again, the census returns are great for that. They describe what the property was like.
How far back can you go? Because once you get into the 19th century, there's good church records, civil records. But as you go earlier to the beginning of the century or the 18th century, do you reach a point where, you know, the materials just aren't there? Are you limited in how far back you can go?
You definitely are. So for most people in Ireland, they will be able to get back to maybe the 1820s with the church records. Before that, it is really just on a geographical basis. So some people will brag maybe and say, I got back to the 17th century. There are Catholic church records for Wexford from the 1600s, but for most of us, we won't get back that far. Now, of course, there are exceptions to that. So we have what we call the registered pedigrees in the genealogical office manuscript collection in the library. Some of those claim descent from biblical times. So families that claimed, you know, that they were descended from thousands of years ago in some cases. So, you know, that's based on an oral tradition that was later written down, where you'd have this bardic tradition of, you know, these Gaelic clans or whatever, and they would claim descent from such a person. But the further back that you go, if you're trying to document the evidence you had before the 1800s, is tricky in Ireland.
Well, it's an absolutely brilliant service that you and the National Library are running. But and it makes you think just how transformational digitization has been. Because if you had 300 people coming into the National Library in a particular month 30 years ago, that might have taken many people a full year or years of work to go through these records and go through these collections. But the fact that you have them digitized and people are digitizing these records and making them accessible, it means the work that might have taken 6 months can now be done in 6 minutes.
Exactly. So I suppose it really has been transformational, not only in how quickly you can access information, but also in the distribution of our researchers. So people don't need to physically visit the library to look at the Catholic Church registers. They can be looking at them at any time, anywhere in the world. And we know that our profile of visitors to the library website, about 2/3 are Irish and 1/3 international. But when it comes to the registers part of the website, it's the opposite. So we know that 2/3 of our researchers are abroad at some time of the day accessing the registers there and looking at them. But in the past, those would have had to be looked at in the library on a microfilm. And you'd have to physically sit down at the microfilm machine, load in the roll. So that's a member of staff probably doing that. If you're new to it, and you're going through manually page by page in the register, whereas now, since those records were digitized, they're searchable in seconds, you know. But there are pros and cons to that, and sometimes the online search doesn't work. You know that a particular name is maybe picked up wrong when it was transcribed and digitized, if you like. So we still rely on those registers to go back and say, well, I know my ancestors are from a particular area. What else can I get from the original image? And I suppose that's where people are crossing the bridge from online research to doing library-based or archive-based research. And that's where the Family History Service really comes into its own, in that we provide advice on how to search the catalogue, how to find resources that might relate to your family and the area they're from.
Well, all Irish historians owe a huge debt to the National Library of Ireland. And the person who really helps coordinate it all, Stephen Skeldon, the manager of the Family History Service at the National Library of Ireland. Stephen, thank you so much for joining us tonight.
Thank you, Patrick.
Well, that brings us to the end of another edition of Talking History, our St. Patrick's weekend show. My thanks to my producer, Mairéad O'Sullivan, to Peter Malloy on sound. We've got more debate and discussion next week, so hope you can join us then. We've been Talking History. Good night.